We're going to get going. We don't quite have a quorum, but we've got the commissioner and his staff here, so why don't we get going?
Probably thinking the same thing.
Deputy Commissioner Schirkenbach, and I hope I didn't, no, I think I did fairly well. Welcome, Commissioner Austin. Welcome. If you guys want to introduce yourself, that'd be great, and then we can start. We're going to do an overview, members of the agency. And what I would prefer is to let the agency go through it, if I'm not mistaken, maybe for an hour or so, and then we can leave those questions. But I will give you the latitude if for some reason you have to leave or really feel something's pressing and you're totally confused, or if we're missing sheets or something, raise your hand, bang on the table, and I will try not forget you, which I absolutely did to Representative Hilty. A couple meetings ago, and Representative Hilty is way too diplomatic. He did not make a scene, and I can tell you, Representative Hilty, Representative McNamara would have made a scene with Chair Wagenius last year, so I owe you an apology, and it was wrong, and thank you for being so diplomatic about that. With that, members, we do have a quorum, so we'll convene the meeting of the House Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources. Welcome, commissioners.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Paul Austin. I'm the commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency, and Chair McNamara and I were talking for a minute and thought it would be helpful if I just came in and talked for a few minutes about what we've been talking about within the agency in the last couple of weeks and some of the priorities we have, and then we'll turn it over to Deputy Commissioner Schirkenbach and some of our other folks to do an overview of the agency. In terms of background on me, I'm a water guy by training. I'm a toxicologist, and I've done a lot of work on water, water toxics, sewage treatment, that kind of thing over the years. So when I think about environmental regulation, I tend to think about it from through that lens and through that perspective, mostly in terms of the Clean Water Act itself. I think the Clean Water Act was an environmental regulation that was built right. It took 20 years for Congress to pass the Clean Water Act, but when they got to the end of the work, they recognized the imminence of the problem, and they put a series of steps in place that were designed to move from places and things we knew to things we didn't know. There were technology requirements for treatment early, and if the technology wasn't enough, there was a second level of technology treatments that were put in to try to clean up the waters and make them fishable and swimmable, and if that wasn't enough, then the regulating and delegated authorities were charged with going out and doing the science and figuring out what that water body needed to help it become fishable and swimmable and, by inference, drinkable. And so this information-based, science- and standards-based kind of thinking about environmental regulation is something that I tend to think about and that the agency has worked on over all these years, whether it's air or water or land. So I think you'll see the agency continue in that vein, but it raises some challenges. In order to do that kind of science and fact-based work, you need the facts. You need to do the science. You need to take the time to go out and do the monitoring or do the analysis that's needed. You need to have smart people. Luckily, we have a lot of smart people. You need the expertise. You need the data management systems. And you need the structure and discipline to go through the hard science, the hard work to find out whether 13 parts per million of cadmium is a problem or whether it should be 6. And then there's a public process that ensues after that to debate the 6 or the 13 a little bit, and then a standard is finally set. But that's the kind of fact-based goal setting that I think you're going to see us pursue and we will intend to pursue to the best of our ability. The agency in some places is now referred to as the once proud Pollution Control Agency. I'd like to get rid of the once proud. I'd like to replace that with the extraordinarily professional and competent and trusted Pollution Control Agency. When I talked to the governor about taking this position, he said, I'd like you to do a few things. And he started using words like fair and impartial and clear and predictable to describe the actions of the agency, the enforcement that the agency takes, both in terms of the regulated parties and the public that the agency is acting on behalf of. So this notion of having a very deliberate, very clear, very open process that is predictable is a challenge that we intend to meet. We need to reestablish some of our credibility in some places. Hopefully that will not be a tough job, but we will strive to do that. We need to reach out to more partners in this business. That's both on the technical side and on the social and economic and political side. We need to put environomics back on the table. When you start talking about costs and benefits of environmental regulation, it's tough. And most of the time we talk about costs, and that's easier for us to quantify. We can quantify the cost of the agency time. We can quantify the cost of the pollution control efforts that the regulated parties go through. But quantifying the benefits is a field that's just emerging. And I think you'll all see over the next decade that the conversation around the social, political, cultural, economic benefits of environmental protection is going to become a bigger and bigger piece of this conversation, and that's good. Right now, I think the agency has one economist. We might need to reach out to some folks who know a lot about economics to start to further flesh out what it means to do this work that we do and how it plays back into the whole economic side of the equation. In terms of really big and high-profile issues that are out there, let's talk about water first. The Clean Water Legacy Act in 2006 is a great benchmark for the management of water in this state and for the intent of carrying out the Clean Water Act, but we've really only got about half that issue resolved. Resolved being maybe an optimistic word, but point sources have been dealt with for a long time. We all have to deal with runoff, whether it's coming off of urban areas or areas outside the urban loops, and that's going to be a tough challenge. We all know that. I've been around the water game for 25 years, and it was part of the conversation 25 years ago. I think the time is right to have the conversation, talking to a wide range of people representing a wide range of interests around this issue. There's conversations that are starting today that weren't going on 5 years ago. So that's good. How we move through that exactly is not clear, but we do know that our agency will need to play a role in helping to identify places on the landscape where targeting efforts will have the greatest benefit to water quality. How we move after that will be part of the greater discussion. Mining is clearly an issue that's out there. Our agency fully anticipates getting permit requests from PolyMet at some point in the future. All the work that will need to be done on that issue is clearly daunting. There's a lot of factors around PolyMet, and in particular as a bellwether of the next phase of regulating mining in this state, that are going to be very, very important. One thing that I think is worth noting is that when I'm sitting thinking as a regulator, I always think about this issue of the balance of contact, the balance of input from all the interests around an issue like mining. I just want to be very clear that I fully anticipate that the Pollution Control Agency is going to spend more time talking to PolyMet than they are anybody else in this process. We have to. In order to understand what they're intending and what they're proposing, our folks have to spend a great deal of time with the regulated party. That doesn't mean that regulated party gets undue influence. So I'd like you to remember that we need to try to separate influence from familiarity. We need to be absolutely familiar with what someone's proposing, but we also need to provide opportunities for other interested parties to have the opportunity to influence the decisions that will be made in that regulatory structure. So we intend to strike that balance as we move forward. I've met with a lot of folks, and the message that I'm getting is very clear from almost everybody. We'd love to have the jobs. We don't want to mess up and fill in the blank. Blank lake or the blank river. That's been a very universal message that fits with the charge of our agency. So we're happy to work on that and make that happen. Air quality is an issue that we will all be talking about for a long time. A non-attainment for particulate, specifically small particles, 2.5 or less, and ozone is out there. And it is probably going to come down in 2 years, maybe 4 years, depending on how the federal standards changes come to pass. If the metro area is declared in non-attainment, we will face an air quality challenge that we've never faced before in this state. And it will require a coalition of partners across every sector, regulatory, public, private, regulated parties, to make it happen, to work through the process to bring the area back into attainment. And it will have the potential to be an economic damper on the metro area. So we're starting conversations now. There's an ongoing effort within Clean Air Minnesota that's existed for a decade, in essence, in anticipation of non-attainment or the potential for non-attainment. This is going to be a big deal. So I just want to hang that out there. With the overview, we'll talk more about it, but we will be talking about what you need to do to get this done, what kind of resources are needed, what kind of knowledge is needed, what kind of partnerships are needed as we move forward. The agency has been active on chemical regulatory reform efforts, how we regulate toxic chemicals in the state. We would like to see that process of reform conversations continue. We think there's a lot of value in bringing together everybody around that conversation and thinking and rethinking how we can make that process, again, more clear, more predictable, more concise, more effective at the end of the day. You're not going to see proposals out of our agency this year, but maybe in future years as that process starts to spool up. It's a very big deal, and everybody who's interacting with this, both on the state level and the federal level, understand how difficult it is to make judgments about toxic chemicals and how frequently we need to hold this conversation to make sure everybody who's a player in the game is up to speed on the issues and the choices that are being made. We do, as the governor has asked us, have an obligation to enforce existing law. We need to do that in a way that is predictable and timely. We also need to make sure that we're not allowing an unfair business advantage for those regulated parties that are not complying with existing law. I learned a lesson a long time ago from a friend who worked for the crop production retailers, and he always told me, you know, most of my members work really hard and spend money to get into compliance with toxic and hazardous chemical handling regulations. Their competitors who don't are actually getting an unfair advantage. So don't ever forget that when you're thinking about this landscape. So there is an interesting economic driver behind fair and impartial enforcement of existing law. And last and not least, we will be confronted with climate change, with carbon regulation, as EPA moves forward with that. On Monday, the state adopted some rules to essentially tailor the early carbon regulation that EPA is coming in with for the state itself. The tailoring rule allowed us to make that regulation reasonable, at least as the first step. If we did not implement that tailoring rule on Monday, large homes, churches, large buildings would have had to get air quality permits, the likes of which they've never had to do before. That didn't make sense to us. So that's step one, but how carbon regulation comes from the feds is going to be an interesting conversation, and we've been very active in that interface, and we will continue to do that. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to take some questions or turn it over to Deputy Commissioner Schirkenbach.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any questions for Commissioner Austin? Representative Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Commissioner, thank you for your thoughts on this. Very interesting. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about what you said about PolyMet and being familiar with the project, but under the folks understanding that for you to understand, you have to be familiar with it. It makes you appear pretty close to it. And I can understand that. I'm thinking about one thing you said, you have challenges ahead to understand that, but also there's challenges for the taconites as well as the proposed mining. And one of them is the sulfate standard, the 10 milligrams per liter. Are you intending to revisit that, since it hasn't been revisited since, what, the 70s or 60s in that neighborhood? And what would be the timeliness on that? Because that could have a real impact on the world demand for steel, even though we've been in a recession, has been going up, and we're up to near 40 million tons, which is the high end of the production on the range, and almost everyone is clamoring for more production. And so it's an important thing, not just for the range, where I represent a part of, but for the state, and it's an economic driver statewide.
Commissioner Austin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, you're absolutely right. The 20 minutes before this meeting were spent talking with a variety of folks about the wild rice standard and sulfates or whatever other issues there may be that are affecting wild rice and how it grows in the wild rice waters of the state. I think there's two layers to that question. The first is, going back to the conversation about water quality-based regulation, we need to go get the facts. So we collectively, and we being the state as a whole, need to go out and do the science, the research, to figure out what is exactly going on with wild rice, sulfates, and or other pollutants that may or may not be affecting the wild rice production. We need to do that in concert with the tribes. We need to do that in concert on some level with EPA. We need to do that in concert with, you know, everyone who's interested. The municipalities are interested in the sulfate standard because it may have an impact on their wastewater treatment facilities. So we fully intend to do that. We're working internally now on some thoughts and proposals and ideas, and we'll see how that fleshes out through the governor's budget. So that's step one. Science takes time, unfortunately. Good science takes time, let's put it that way. So in the meantime, we will also have to face the issue of how we implement the existing standard. And there are flexibilities in the Clean Water Act and in the permitting process that will allow us to deal with timelines that would allow us to address both the existing standard and this need for more information and improvement to our knowledge and potentially the standards as we move forward. I'm a little concerned that at the end of the day, maybe it's not sulfates. Maybe it's stream flows. Maybe it's chlorides. There's potential for a mercury connection to this whole conversation. So that's why we really need the knowledge before we can move more definitively.
Follow up, Representative Deal.
Well, thank you very much for that. And I obviously, you know, it's real important. I just wanted to give you, for the record, I think that the Range delegation of legislators is pretty united behind this thing on polymeth and the other precious metal non-ferrous mines is that. And sometimes we're perceived as being familiar to the point that we're just blindly supporting. But the truth is that I live, if you permit the two mines that are not in with EISs or proposals at this point, that water runs right by my front door, right in front of my dock, and goes to the Hudson Bay. And you know, all of us agree that if they can't do it right, then go home. We don't want it. And I just want to let you know that, because it's a very passionate issue, and it's simple as that. If it's not done right, it can't be done right, it can't demonstrate it can be right, but if it can be done right, then we want it. We want it. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Beer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just kind of take off on Representative Dill's comment about doing it right. A few moments ago, you were talking about this group called Clean Air Minnesota, which is a new phrase to me, and this business about the coming crisis of non-attainment. One of the concerns I have, Commissioner, in watching this over the last handful of years here, is that we're doing it right at one point, and then all of a sudden we're doing it wrong because somebody changed the standard on us. And sometimes those standard changes kind of sneak up on some of us that are busy doing other things and defending liberty and freedom and the right to own property, do business, and things that we hold near and dear, and we think we're doing it pretty well, but then the standards change. A case in point was an article about the smelter in Eagan, where I used to live. I spent millions and millions of dollars coming into compliance and attainment to clean up the air for lead emissions and other odors around that place, and all of a sudden they're out of attainment again because somebody changed the standard. Who is Clean Air Minnesota, and how do they impact this? The moving the goalposts around. And then I have a couple follow-ups with that, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Austin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, Clean Air Minnesota is a coalition of the Pollution Control Agency, the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, Flint Hills, the large power generators, the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, a variety of construction interests, a variety of other transportation interests, the Minnesota Department of Transportation, and about two or three environmental advocacy groups. This group was formed in 1998, specifically in anticipation of the issues with non-attainment at that point in time. It, because the region did not go into non-attainment for air pollution, It has directed its time and energy at Project Green Fleet, which is the retrofitting of school buses to prevent exposure of children on school buses to diesel emissions. And over the last couple years, that project has been an extraordinary success. And Clean Air Minnesota, as a coalition, has been interacting and watching the federal debate around air quality standards, not interacting necessarily as an entity on the federal level. Each of the groups or sectors has been interacting in through their own channels in that conversation. But when it has become clear that the knowledge about what low-level ozone exposures do for asthma triggers, for example, and what low levels, what fine particulate impacts do to human lungs, the group itself has started to redirect its focus away from the diesel retrofits again and back to this issue of non-attainment, which has some extraordinarily stringent federal requirements that come with it.
Follow-up, Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for illuminating the list of who's on there. I hear there's a lot of NGOs. It encourages me that there's real people that do real things that move society ahead on that commission. It concerns me that there's some of these NGOs out there that run around the edges of the process and sue people to make things stop, to stop things from happening. But nonetheless, it sounds like there might be some balance there. But if I understand correctly, the tightening of the belt, the tightening of the standards appears to be driven from Washington. Is this on some pre-programmed timeline, or is Washington reacting to pressure from interest groups? And does Clean Air Minnesota actually kind of advocate and defend common sense, or do we just stand back, observe, and prepare for the coming onslaught?
Commissioner Austin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, Clean Air Minnesota itself is not lobbying for or against standards in Washington. Each of the sectors that's represented there has its own lobbying effort. The agency has its own presence in this conversation with EPA about standards. The standards are not moving on a predetermined timeline. The standards move as the science moves. And the science that is driving this conversation is one that develops, similar to the lead issue. There was a point in time where there was assumed that there was a threshold exposure for lead below which the impacts on the development of children was negligible. Current research suggests that there may be no threshold. That's why you get movement in standards and attainment standards like the smelter and EGAN. And that research is not coming out of the blue. It's an ongoing public health effort that people have undertaken for decades. And it's always challenging for an industry that's trying to spend a lot of money to come into compliance only to have the floor move. Fully understand that. But that's why most of the major media acts also have allowances within the regulatory process, within the permitting process, to accommodate timelines for people to come into compliance that hopefully don't make the change too onerous.
Representative Beard.
And Commissioner, thank you for the explanation. It's appreciated. I would just encourage as we go ahead that we kind of keep in mind an end game, if there is an end game. If it's going to be based on good science, I think we can all work together towards that goal. If it's driven by some other ideology or something we need to know about, already my spider sense is tingling, so to speak. But thank you for that assurance. And I would just encourage you, as we're doing this and we're looking at the science and the balance, that you take into account the positive forcings that technology, chemicals, and human activity bring to the earth, and just kind of recognize who is at the top of the food chain and why we're here. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Beard. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner Austin, welcome to the committee. Glad you're here today. Thank you for coming. I would like you to address something that's, I think, been talked about quite a bit since your appointment, and that is how you perceive the role of the courts in environmental regulation as we move forward, given your old job compared to your new job. How does that all fit together?
Commissioner Austin.
Mr. Chair and Representative Torkelson, I'd like to offer two perspectives. One is I fully anticipate and look forward to the day when my former employer sues me. I suspect that is going to happen. I will frame that lawsuit and hang it on the wall. That's part of the public process. the appeals that are part of the regulatory process that could eventually end up in court are part of the decision-making chain that's available. When you think about how folks, regulated parties, advocacy groups, citizens interact with the agencies, there's an administrative component to that interaction, and that's where folks talk to our staff and ask for interpretations of law and rule and you know, application to their particular situation. And at some point in there, there's a decision that gets made. The timelines and the certainty of those decisions are improving. We're trying to make them faster, but they aren't always as defined and as definite as either the interested parties outside the agency would like them. So you can talk in this administrative chain and try to get an answer you like or an answer you want or an answer that makes sense to you. If you don't get it, the next stop usually is here. Because of the temporal nature of the session, when it runs from January through May, people believe there's a time and a place where they can get an answer, they can drive a discussion and get an answer. So this is another forum for getting decisions out of the organization. And the last one is the courts. And the courts is the most constrictive in terms of the process and the type of conversation you can have. It's also the most defined as far as the outcome that you're asking for. So I fully expect that we will make decisions that regulated parties will not like, and they will take us to court over them. And I fully expect we will make decisions that advocacy groups won't like, and they will take us to court over them. But it's all part of this public process that allows those safety valves, recheck, feedback loops. And I think, you know, we should welcome that public process because it allows the conversation to take place in more and more predictable ways until you can drive to an answer point that is as defined as a court ruling. That's just part of that continuum of debate, and I think that's a very reasonable system for us to operate in.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a brief follow-up. You know, one of the assets that you mentioned in your remarks is the asset of time. Timeliness of permitting and timeliness of decision-making is certainly important to all of us, and it seems to me, anyway, that sometimes groups utilize the court system to waste our time. Could you comment on that, please?
Commissioner Austin.
I think it's always tricky to define intent by court action. The notion that it's a that the idea of using if the idea of using the courts to waste time isn't what the courts were put there for. And I can just speak to the organization I came from for a moment. That organization was recognized in 2009 by the American Bar Association for excellence in environmental law. You don't get that kind of recognition by frivolously using the courts. You have to use them for the purpose they are intended. I know that sitting in the chair I'm sitting in now, I don't want to waste time on frivolous lawsuits. If there's a legitimate issue, we're happy to go battle in the courts about it. But if it's not legitimate, I'm not interested in entertaining that from this seat at this time.
Thank you.
Commissioner, a follow-up to Representative Torkelson. A couple of things. I don't think we need to get totally into the weeds now, but I hope that that you would be able to justify the lawsuit up in Representative Fabian's district that took place over what's alleged to be $12,000 project to clean up some beaver dams and brush piles. I know you mentioned to me there probably is another side to that story, and I assume there is. And I think just we should all be cognizant of the fact that maybe that got simplified in its discussion a little bit about a project to remove a couple beaver dams and a brush pile. But at the same point, we should be thinking about the implications when we go to disrupt. And I would rather see us work together to resolve these issues than get to the point to where we spend hundreds of thousands of dollars and really disrupt people's lives and their thoughts of the agencies and how they look. And along those lines, it's troubling for me to see the agency join the Attorney General in the lawsuit against a very large employer on East Metro, the 3M company. I hope that's not something that we see as a movement forward and an expansion of what we're going to see, because I think we should be working together in trying to resolve issues. The agency has legitimate concerns about this lawsuit, and I understand that, but that's a very important employer for us and important to the state, to our history, to the region, and so I just hope that we can work together on these issues. And I don't know if you want to comment. I laid a bunch on there, a couple of things that have got me a little excited, and I saw Representative Fabian writing and raising in his seat, so I thought I would hit the District 1A one at the same time as I did the 3M issue.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, Representative Fabian and I are meeting this afternoon, so we'll have a continue a conversation about all the issues that, that he may have questions about. To your comment about is it easier to work together up front? Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's where we always need to start. That's where the agency has been. That's where we'll continue to be. There also comes points in time where you need to drive to a decision, and sometimes, unfortunately, that ends up being a protracted effort like a lawsuit. But if everybody is in the conversation, everyone's part of the conversation up front, then it would be no surprise if we reach that kind of an impasse, and I think that would be a future that I would hope we would be able to get to.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for being here today. And one of the concerns that I have, really, it started, I think it was last year in D.C., where the administration kind of did an end run around the legislature and the Congress by stating that and making it part of their policy that CO2 was a pollutant. And one of the things related on this on the state level that concerns me is your past organization that you came from advocates for accomplishing things through administrative action. And that concerns me greatly that it seems, again, like what's going on in Washington is coming down to a state level, and the end run is being done around the legislative process and administrations, or administrations, administrative agencies such as yours are making policy, and that's really the legislature's position. I'd like to hear your feedback on that.
Commissioner Austin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, administrative action, and I'll just speak to it from a state perspective. I'm not trying to address it on the federal level, but the administrative leeway or interpretation or action that is available to an agency is defined by law. If we move outside of that law, we can be challenged and will be challenged. And that's, you know, that is part of the delegation, that's part of the public debate that led to the enabling legislation of EPA, Pollution Control Agency, DNR, Department of Commerce, Department of Transportation, fill in the blank. It's all, you know, we are all bound to operate within those statutes, those delegated authorities, regardless of what we may or may not want to do administratively internally. So the vehicles exist to check actions by administrative agencies if we move too far. I've got a personally a long history of working within state and regional government and with federal interfaces, and how agencies interpret law is a very important piece of this chain. But we are subject to that kind of check and balance both by any interested party if we in fact are operating outside of the law as it exists.
Follow-up, Representative Scott.
This is actually not a follow-up, it's a different question, but a lot is being talked about outdoor air quality and that sort of thing, and Representative Beard was talking about the changing of the standards. And one thing that I think is overlooked many times is that as human beings, we spend 90% of our time indoors. Mm-hmm. And there's most of the issues that cause health problems are caused by indoor air quality. And I just think we need to take a practical approach to some of this and not blame some of these companies that may be, you know, approaching. Right now, their quality is improving in our state and in our country. But at the same time, I think that I don't know where I'm trying to go with this exactly, except to say that we need to put everything in perspective. And are we going to, you know, as the MPCA, or the, is, I don't know what I'm trying to get at here, except that I think that we just need to have balance and not put, that's, we just need balance.
Comment, Commissioner Austin?
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, when I think about a regulator's job, it is to stand in balance between the opposing forces, the opposing positions on issues. So absolutely right. Balance is the key. I think one of the things that you're going to see out of this administration is an even tighter working relationship between agencies that are involved in the same issues. So if we're talking about air quality, the Health Department and the Pollution Control Agency sure better be talking, because that's the bridge between indoor and outdoor air quality issues. There's very different sources of indoor and outdoor air quality exposures. You know, only by putting the two agencies together can you have that conversation in a reasonable way to figure out what is the problem? Where is the risk here? Is it inside? Is it outside? Is it something burning? Is it something being emitted accidentally? What is going on? So I think we're in agreement. Balance is important, and our partnerships between in the cabinet are going to become even more important as we start to work through the budget, quite frankly. None of us are going to have all the resources to do everything. So we're going to have to pool our resources and our smart people and try to do the best and most important things first.
Commissioner, I have four more people that would like to ask you questions. I want to be cognizant of your time, so if we could go through those, because I know you, we are beyond the time you had originally thought you'd be here, but I do want to give members a chance to all of them ask their questions. Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Commissioner, what are the plans to validate and to verify some of the dictates and rules that we've had over the decades on things such as water retention ponds, vegetation, and et cetera, so that we can, it's much easier to get a buy-in from the public and the community and our job creators if they understand that the rules are based on results and reality and not just theoretical basis.
Commissioner Austin.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think there's a couple of pieces to that puzzle. One is with the Clean Water Legacy Act and the Clean Water Fund and the constitutional amendment that was passed in 2008, the actual information gathering on water bodies around the state is improving dramatically. So this notion of, are these actions that are being taken on the landscape to protect the water actually protecting the water? We're starting to get into a position where we can answer that question better than ever. So that's point one. Point two is the issues that you're talking about actually span about four agencies, maybe five or six if you start putting the federal agencies in there. We've got an obligation to be smart and coordinate government. We have a role in that. We intend to play a role in that conversation to make sure that whoever's on the ground isn't just getting hit by layer after layer after layer of government, and that the requirements synchronize and make some sense to have a real outcome in the water body, which is the intent of the work in the first place.
Follow-up, Representative Qualm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Commissioner, you touched on the points that, you know, four, five, six agencies and bureaucracies are involved in water, for example. What is your suggestion on how to combine so that we don't have our job creators going to all these different groups? How can we combine that down so that we have a more uniform and unified approach and location for this regulatory and rural authority?
Commissioner Austin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Qualm, two things. There's a law in the books in this state, I believe it was passed in 72, that directs the Department of Commerce to shepherd regulated parties through the regulatory process when they're interacting with state agencies. Now, it's important to note that that's only can mandate that action at the state level, but that kind of thinking, that kind of shepherding is something that clearly needs to happen so the regulated parties have a point of entry that they're comfortable with. They don't have to go to three or four points of entry. We've started this conversation at the cabinet level, and I think you're going to see movement and action in that direction to actually implement a law that is now very, very old. The second thing is we have to have a blunt conversation between all the levels of government as to who all wants a piece of this action. The local, the city, county, state, federal controls that are all there didn't appear overnight, and they didn't appear by accident. Someone at that level of government was interested in participating in this conversation for some reason. If it's too confusing and there's a desire to streamline it, you actually have to compress across all those levels of government, and then we start running into the issue of usurping local control, potentially. And that's a very difficult conversation to have. I know from my days in public safety, starting on the ground is best, but it has to be coordinated all the way up as you bring specialized resources and expertise to bear. So that's a tough conversation. It's one that I've had with Craig Johnson from the League of Minnesota Cities before. I'm sure we're going to have some more conversations about that, particularly as everybody's budgets get pinched down.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me. Commissioner Austin, thank you for being here. I look forward to our meeting this afternoon and the conversations that we have had up to this point. Let me start out by saying that my dad used to tell me, you know what happens when you beat a dead horse, right? The horse is still dead, of course. And I don't mean to sound like I'm beating a dead horse, because in my opinion, this horse isn't dead, and it's the permitting process. Mm-hmm. I believe that in the state of Minnesota, we're at a crossroads in our economy and our business climate. And HF1 is designed to help move us on a path in that crossroads that's going to allow for future expansion and startup of businesses here in Minnesota and make it easier. For too long in the permitting process, the people that I talk to feel like we've been adversaries instead of partners. And you have alluded somewhat to that, I believe, in some of your comments, and I appreciate that. I would like to see us be more partners in the process than adversaries. Also want to know that people know that we do live in these areas. I mean, my constituents live there. We are concerned about the environment. All that being said, I'd like to know what your opinion is about, in HF1 we've proposed allowing the proposer to work directly with the consultant to prepare the EIS. I assume that you understand that those documents that are involved in the preparation of the EIS and so forth would be made obviously available to your agency to make sure that they can make a decision, and all the amendments and so forth that are in there, and that would be public information. And I'd just like your comment on how you see that process. Thank you.
Commissioner Austin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, just to step back just a click, I see the conversation that's going on around environmental review and permitting having four steps to it. Step one was the executive order that was issued by the governor the other day. Those were the pieces of House File 1, Senate File 1 that there's violent agreement about, and we can move administratively within the bounds of the authorities we've got. So we said, we agree, let's go. That's step one. Step two are the other pieces of House File 1, Senate File 1 that are left to be talked about. We have no concerns about talking about those, reaching agreement on those, moving those through the process. The issue that you are asking directly about, it affects local governments much more than it affects us at the state level, because we've got the staff in-house that are available to review documents, environmental impact statements, and as they come through. So from the state's perspective, we don't appear to have a big issue with that proposal at all, if any issue. I think it's worth talking to some of the local units of government and making sure that they're comfortable with that proposal as well and what it may mean to them. There's another piece of House File 1 that has to do with changing the point of appeal from the district courts to the Court of Appeals directly. Again, from a state perspective, we don't oppose that. We think that makes some sense. So that's step two in this four-step dance about dealing with these issues. Step three, I believe, will be triggered by the legislative auditor's report and other ideas that spool up during the legislative session. Hopefully we'll see the auditor's report before the end of February, and hopefully there's some really good analysis of barriers, issues, opportunities that may exist in both environmental review and permitting. looking forward to that conversation. Step four, when we start talking about environmental review in a very broad context, some of the smart people who have been around this game a long time have been thinking maybe there are some bigger and broader and systemic things we should think about. So the conversation inside the cabinet right now is about starting that conversation with the hopes that maybe a year from now or so we'll have some even better ideas about how to make things move faster without compromising environmental protection. That would hopefully make everybody a little bit happier with the process. So I see this as a very long-term conversation. And then, quite frankly, I'm hoping a decade from now it loops again and goes through exactly the same steps, because that's the kind of attention and knowledge that people need to have about this process to make sure it works right.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Ozen, you mentioned that you're a water guy, so I'm interested in hearing your opinion on a proposed change in the Clean Water Act a couple of years back by Congressman Oberstar that caused quite a stir in farming country. That changed the wording from navigable waters of the state to just waters of the state. What was your take on that proposed change?
Commissioner Austin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, my understanding Congressman Oberstar's proposal was he was trying to reestablish the original intent of the Clean Water Act that had been changed by some court rulings along the way. And so this issue of defining exactly what waters does the Clean Water Act apply to it's a big challenge and a long and ongoing conversation. We are blessed in this state by having a lot of different kinds of water, and all that water is coming under pressure now. So I think regardless of where it sits in the spectrum of navigable or fishable or drinkable, I think whether it's state or local concern about the quality of that water, that's a conversation I think we have to have and try to do our best to simply protect the resources that we do have. It's very tough. It's not easy when you start talking about waters that are on private lands, waters that people have viewed as theirs for a long period of time. I don't have a great answer to where you draw that line, but I know that was the intent of what the congressman was doing and trying to bring back to the conversation, and I suspect we'll have to have that again here in the near future at some point.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for talking with us today. I've got a memo here from the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy from back in November, and I don't know if you were still employed by them then or not, but one of their goals is to work to have state government implement recommendations of the Sustainable Water Framework through administrative action, and I assume that means rulemaking process. Is it your intent to encourage or discourage this activity?
Commissioner Austin.
Chair, Representative Drazkowski, I was employed there in November, so I do know what that means. Currently, most state agencies, not just the Pollution Control Agency, but narrowing it down to Pollution Control Agency, is not necessarily following the law. There is guidance from EPA, for example, on how to implement certain sections of the Clean Water Act. There are parts of that arguably this state has not been doing or not been doing efficiently. That's what that refers to. There are pieces of the Sustainable Water Framework that it makes sense to implement, like monitoring, like working on cleanup plans, and those are things that we're committed to, have been committed to. It's not a surprise that it showed up in the Sustainable Water Framework, because it's an issue that a lot of people have worked on for the last decade. So that's what that refers to.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One other question, Commissioner. You talked about climate change in your presentation, and we really don't need to get in the weeds about that. But we do know historically Earth's temperatures have been up and down over time. 1,500 years ago, we were very warm here. In terms of climate change, how do you see climate changing in the future?
Commissioner Austin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jaskowski, if I knew how the climate was going to change in the future, I suspect I'd be hired by a large insurance company to predict future disasters, because that is one of the great drivers of this whole conversation. I'm not sure I understand your question totally.
Representative Jaskowski, clarification.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Commissioner, if we don't know exactly how climate's going to change in the future, how can we base our policy and leadership in the state around it?
Commissioner Austin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jaskowski, about 5 years ago, I believe it was ING Insurance, a big, big global insurance company, in their annual report, had a long section on climate change. They didn't try to address the genesis or origins of climate change. They were just trying to address the issue that climate is changing. And in their world, it is reflected in the number of natural disasters that occur, and then the payouts that they as an insurer have to incur. I think if you have an insurance giant like ING, and they weren't the only one, but insurance actuaries who are looking at the information that's available, they tend to be extraordinarily conservative in their approach to their analysis. And if they're concluding that the climate is changing, then I think it's important for us to pay attention to that and assume that there are changes that are occurring out there and try to figure out what, if anything, we can do about it. So that's where the state of the debate is right now. That's where the federal government is when they're working on climate change regulation that is trickling down to us. And that's the issue that we will have to confront and will continue to confront as we move forward.
Thank you, Commissioner. We appreciate you coming in this morning. Deputy Commissioner Schirkenbach, if you want to go through your presentation, that would be great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tim Schirkenbach. I am Deputy Commissioner of the MPCA. And with me today are David Thornton and Rebecca Flood, two assistant commissioners. David's the assistant commissioner at the Agency for Air, and Rebecca Flood is assistant commissioner for Water. They're here also as backup because they deal with policy issues in those media areas as it relates to our federal partnership and as also it relates to all kinds of issues here in the state. I do have to say it's been interesting for me to listen to this. And you've got interesting bookends here. You've got Commissioner Austin just coming on, starting at the agency. And again, as you've seen, doing a very impressive job of understanding the issues. I have been here now, it'll be almost 40 years. So I started before the Clean Water Act was passed, actually. So it gives me a little different perspective on some of these issues. It was interesting for me to listen to a lot of the responses of the commissioner, because I think he's probably did a lot better job than I would on many of those. But as we get into the discussion, if there's additional questions, we can do that. I will try to move through here quickly, and I think, as you said, Mr. Chairman, questions, if there's clarification questions at the time, that's just fine with me. But again,
Deputy Commissioner, I think, excuse me, Representative McGinnis, did you, I think we'll ask you to get through your presentation, if you could, before 10. And then if we have questions that are of the utmost urgency, we'll have the members jump in. But we would like to get through here because we do need to be done with you today.
Okay. Thank you very much. We will move ahead very quickly. The presentation today, two different parts you're going to see. I'm going to talk a little bit about our organizational structure, and then more importantly, I'll get into the issue of our programs, where we actually deal with our activities and how we address the important issues, many of which have come up even in your questioning of the commissioner in his initial presentation. With regard to the organization, again, getting back, our mission is working with Minnesotans to protect, conserve, and improve our environment. The key thing I want to mention here is, again, we have roughly one staff person at the agency, the way I look at, for every 5,000 citizens in the state. The only way we can get things done is through, again, leveraging all kinds of partnerships, all kinds of other assistance, all kinds of other groups. So it's, again, that idea, 10 times 10 times 10, all of a sudden you've had a tremendous impact. We try to do it that way. However, we don't shy away from those things that are our responsibility alone, and I think that'll come up as we deal with some of these things.
A very unique thing for the MPCA is the fact that we do have a 9-member citizens board. And I think at different times people have heard about some of the issues that have come before that board. Actually, they mainly deal with 3 main issues. They deal with rulemaking issues, they deal with environmental review issues, and then they deal with permitting issues. However, other controversial issues that can come up before them relative to TMDLs and other types of things, if somebody asks the board to have an issue before them. And so, again, that does happen. 2 things are important to say. The commissioner, now Commissioner Austin, is the chair of that board. And secondly, the majority of the decisions and issues that the agency deals with do not come before that board. Again, the board meets once a week, once a month. It would be impossible for all the issues that we deal with to come to them. So there's definitely a screening and a decision on which issues are appropriate for that board to make. I'd like to finally say, though, I think there's a very important benefit that comes from that. I think often the public feels that they're not being heard. And again, no matter how hard we try as staff, that may still happen. And so it's often important to make sure that they have this body that they can come to that are made up of citizens that they can work with. One last thing about that is, 2 are in statute, 2 are kind of directed to be in particular areas. 1 is supposed to be coming from a labor background, and another is supposed to come from an agricultural farming background. So those are 2 interests that, again, through statutes, it's declared that they are important to be represented on that board. About the agency organization, as you can see, we have about 920 staff. And again, we have central office in St. Paul, and then we have 7 regional offices. We have about 1/3 of our staff are in regional offices. And the balance there, and that's what you're going to hear from me over and over, is how we do balance issues. And the balance on where how many you have out and how many in is simple. You'd like to have people out close to the public, close to the issues if possible. But at the same time, given that we only have 920 staff, you also have to deal with centralized functioning in order to deal with the efficiencies you get by a group working together so that they can shift their priorities and deal with issues from different parts of the state as they may come up, because there's no way you can plan ahead and have a certain sense of exactly where the issues are going to fall in the next year, 2 years, or 5 years. So that's why we do it that way. Again, an interesting thing. We, in February of 2008, since then, we are down 100 positions. And actually, since December of 2009, we're down 21 positions. We have been going through a decline in the number as we consider kind of the sustainability issue. We've looked at the question of funding. We've seen kind of the writing on the wall. And we've been understanding that we kind of could not sustain ourselves at the numbers we were at. And we understood that we did need to keep coming down, so we weren't going through these up and down roller coaster rides on the number of staff we have. So that has been happening. And we also have used the early retirement. There's 21 people that are going to be retiring from the agency during this next period. I am one of those that will be gone at the end of June. So again, we're trying to deal with people at all levels, including at the deputy commissioner. There will be a replacement there, but what I'm trying to say is staff are leaving, but we're also trying to strip down and streamline the agency at all levels as we are doing that. With regard to the federal authority, that's come up. And the question that came up from Representative Beard as far as what's happening, again, there is a structure of federal laws in this country. And really, most states then are acting for the federal government in the state in dealing with those laws. So we are delegated those programs. So all of these I can go through. I've been here when all of these passed as far as different federal laws. And then again, what makes sense is for the state to be functioning to implement those. But again, there is an oversight role from the federal government. We have regions, 10 regions in the country. We are in Region 5 with 5 other states. And so then again, they play an oversight role, and they provide funding to us with the program responsibilities that we get. I will say one interesting thing that's come up, though. When right now, 15% of the state's budget comes from the federal government. Back in 86, 88, roughly 50%. That was kind of the tipping point. Before that, more than half of the agency's budget came from the federal government again. Since that point in time, we've gone down where it's only 15% of the state budget. And again, I think what that comes to too is more responsibilities, more sense that the state should be funding their programs. That makes a lot of sense because, again, to think that one structure of environmental laws and ways of implementing those laws makes the same sense for Minnesota as it does for Arizona or as it does for Idaho does not make sense. And so I think more and more EPA is understanding that to some extent. And so how we deal with water issues, how we deal with the air issues and others, there's a lot of differences, and I think EPA is finally beginning to understand that and doing a decent job of allowing states to proceed on those. What the next one I would like to do is showing you the divisions. And again, going to organizations, right now we have 8 divisions at the agency, and then we have 27 different programs. And again, programs just mean, you'll see later, things like our feedlot program, things like our cleanup program, Superfund program, and whatever are what we consider programs. We have to operate all those because of all the different federal and state laws. What we try to do is kind of a matrix management approach, meaning no matter how you slice and dice this, and later on if I can get into the issue of water agencies, no matter how you slice and dice an agency and its structure, you still end up having to work across all the different lines that you have. There's just no way. And I've been involved in national organizations for the last 40 years. And again, you can look at many different structures across the country. And again, no matter how they do it, they still have to figure out how they're going to manage media issues, how they're going to manage functional issues, how they're going to manage relationships with major sectors or groups. So no matter which way you're structured, it's not going to be perfect for all of those relationships or all those issues you're going to have to deal with. So I have found at least structure is not the panacea no matter which way you go. You still have to work with the coordination and communication across those lines as you deal with it. Again, what we'll try to do here is get... air programs. So what this is showing that, again, therefore, as we are dealing with media areas, there's different divisions that are involved. And that's all the next 3 slides as well will show you. So as we're dealing with the air program, here's the 3 divisions that you'll be involved in. Again, that raises some concerns sometimes from the outside. Why can't I just talk to one person? And again, it's just the way the structures of the different programs. There isn't just one person responsible. However, I think we do a very good job of always identifying a point person that somebody will work with so that it's our job to manage those issues internally rather than expecting somebody from the outside to do that. And I think we do a pretty good job. On the land programs, here's the 5 divisions that are involved in those. Go through these quickly. On the water program, again, 5 different groups that are involved in dealing with those. And finally, I'll get to at the end too, talking about our assistance programs, and you'll see the 2 different divisions that are involved in dealing with that. And now what I'll do quickly is go and we'll talk about the 4 different media areas that we work on, or at least that we identify and kind of structure a lot of our programs around. First one is in the air program, and this again in our budget. We have an air category for our budget, and that's what I'll get in, identify the work areas that are involved there. We look at this as far as 2 primary sets of programs, those that we consider under the category of ambient air and those that we consider under the category of air regulatory. And you can see those different types of issues that are addressed in those programs. First, regard to the ambient air program. Again, you see what it looks at. It provides credible data and information. That came up here. Very important for Commissioner Austin. It's been very important for the agency. You have to have good information to be making decisions on. Second one is it's about identifying air pollutants, and main thing is where are they coming from? And that's what you'll see in here. A lot of times it's the idea that we deal with pollutants one at a time, but often the more efficient way is to understanding what is the activity or source area that they're coming from, so then you can figure out what's a strategy for addressing those as you deal with it. We also then do develop the strategies to reduce air pollution as we see that specific problems are arising, and also we operate prevention programs. We all know it makes sense to deal with something proactively rather than waiting for it to happen. Unfortunately, that always isn't the luxury that we have. Often we are dealing with problems as they arise. That's what gets the priority. Therefore, that's what gets our attention as we're dealing with it. Next map, important to talk about trends. And I think it was one of the representatives made a mention is we are getting better. We have gotten better in the state, and you'll see on the different trends that are here. So when you're looking at SO2, the yellow line, you can see over the years how that has improved in that area. And you'll see on all the other pollutants. The thing to look at or understand on this one is the National Ambient Air Quality Standards is represented by the red line. Again, these aren't specific numbers. They're percentages of a value. And so we can normalize all these on one graph. What it is also showing, though, is that we expect, and Commissioner Austin talked about it, there's two pollutants that we expect in the future to possibly have problems with, and those are PM2.5 and, again, a possible new ozone standard. And those, again, will be things done at the federal level. In this state, basically, relative to air standards for the conventional criteria pollutants, we basically are at the same level as the federal government. We do have two things you'll hear is that there are differences in this state. They usually apply to things such as where we do have an additional standard that doesn't exist at the federal level. Hydrogen sulfide is one of those that we now have in this state in order to deal with some of the issues of odor and feedlots and those type of things. So we do have those. Secondly, there's an issue as you're dealing with permitting as far as reviewing issues. And air toxics is something where states have a review process to determine if there is a problem and something needs to be done. And I think it's fair to say as we are kind of in the middle of states as far as our review process, as far as how long it takes. And again, it's balancing. On one side, you want to do it right. On the other side, you want to do it in a timely way. I think we feel very comfortable in the state. We've reached a reasonable balance on how we deal with the timeliness versus the quality of the review that we are doing in dealing with that. This next one is something that is we are kind of proud of in the state, and it deals with the idea of modeling, using modeling tools. Again, Commissioner Austin also talked about that. A big thing to do is figure out how do you look ahead and understand, again, where you should be spending your time. And again, I think maybe it's easier on your own handout on this. And what this shows is we also like to break down. This is of the metro area, and what we'd like to do is break it down and understand where are the major sources of the problems relative to the different air pollutants that we're looking at. And you can see the key thing I would point out here is when you're talking about the point sources, you can see on that there's only a few areas that have some major hot spots. Again, they're still meeting the standards, but at least it's showing that's where concentrations are higher as a result of point sources. Now as you go across to the right, you can see that non-point sources, though, and that's relative to wood burning, dry cleaning, gas stations, and others, then you see that you really kind of looks at the population density that you have in the metropolitan area. That's what you're somewhat seeing happening there, somewhat related to the population and density of business and industries. As you go down the lower corner on the left, then all of a sudden those bottom two deal with mobile sources. One are non-road mobile sources, and again, that's a fact that we're seeing as we deal with ozone and fine particulate issues. We're going to see that even the issue of boats, trains, farm equipments, ATVs, lawnmowers, and those type of things are having an impact, and at some point those are things we may want to look at. And then finally on the other is on-road mobile sources, and this shouldn't be a surprise, but you can see the higher concentrations there definitely correlate to the major roadways in the metro area. So that's, again, something that we use as we help to figure out where we should be looking and what type of sources are really creating the problems that we're trying to address. I should also say that in addition to the concerns on particulate and ozone, three other areas are kind of on our radar screen. One is, again, diesels and particulate, so diesel particulate matter. And that's an issue we'll talk about later. We're Clean Air Minnesota and others. As a result of some partnerships with them, we've been able to do some things as far as the bus fleet and other things. And we've had help from the legislature in dealing with those. Also formaldehyde and acrolein. And that comes from fossil fuel combustion. And that's something we're going to have to keep our eyes on in the future to understand if we're trending towards problems in those areas. And finally, PAHs, dioxins, and furans. And again, I'll get to that a little later, but a large part of that is actually relative to burn barrels. The fact that we're seeing that in rural Minnesota, about 40% of citizens still use burn barrels for getting rid of municipal waste. And that's creating a problem as they're burning plastics and other things that should not be in their waste stream. The air quality regulatory, this is the one most people think about and Paul was talking about. And here we're talking about 35 facilities that basically are permitted and inspected on some type of a periodic schedule by the agency. And right now I think the good news is we are seeing a 95% compliance rate amongst that whole range of permits. And again, we have a range of different permits we use to try to deal with things in an efficient manner. So some facilities require a permit that takes a lot of time, has a lot of monitoring, has a lot of information that's needed with the application and even for construction. And yet others, we use general permits. We're basically up front, they register, we understand again what their overall loading of a pollution source or pollution is of different pollutants. And then basically we just have a general permit that's out there that they are responsible for complying with rather than issuing an individual permit at that time. So we're trying to use a range of tools, again, to balance our resources and yet still address the issues in an appropriate way. It still allows us to go out and do inspections of those facilities, and if there's non-compliance, we still have a basis for acting if we feel that that's appropriate to do. This one's just talking about the major program challenges, and actually some of them came up already. One is we're going to have to address new federal air quality standards. And again, I think as what's happened in this area, and I've seen it throughout the years, and I think it's confusing for people, as we continue to spend a lot of effort, resources to deal with pollution issues, it seems that we still have new rounds of issues coming up. And it's really about the idea of advancing technology and advancing science as far as understanding the impacts on pollution on both humans and also our ecosystem. We're going to have to, therefore, in the second bullet, implement new federal regulations and implement those into permits. And we've got to figure out how we can make sure we're doing that in a timely way, but that's going to take a lot of resources, and we have to figure out how to get that done. We also have to look at, and as Paul said, and you saw in that one graph, it's not just point sources anymore, it's all these other sources, so we're going to have to figure out how we can keep reducing health risks posed by other key pollutants, including air toxics, as we deal with that. And again, that's going to relate to that last bullet. We're going to have to recognize that mobile and non-point sources are a major part of the problem. And that's going to be not just our agency. As Paul indicated, that's going to have to be us working with other agencies as well, both at a state level and at a local level, and then EPA at a federal level on dealing with some of those. Next, I will go into the land programs, do a quick review. Very simple. Here's what's in our strategic plan as far as our vision for this. And again, as I use different terms, as an agency, what we are trying to do is we have a strategic plan that lays out kind of our goals and where we want to be in 3 to 5 years. We use that as a long-term planning document. Again, we continually revise it because we always look at that idea, no matter what you think you should be doing in the future now, it's going to change as you move ahead. So we're always doing that kind of plan, do, check, and adapt model at the agency. It sounds simple, but that's what I think you always have to be doing. No matter which path you head down in the future, you always see there needs to be some modification, and we try to use a variety of different tools to make sure that we're adjusting accordingly to how things are changing. Here are the 8 different programs that we deal with, and different programs that we deal with in the land area, at least how we group those. And again, what we've done over on the right side, and we could have done it in the other areas quite as clearly or distinctly, is there's 3 different overall type of programs that we do run. There are cleanup programs. I'll get into those. It's clear what those are. There's management programs, where, again, things happen, and what you're trying to do is minimize the consequence of what is happening. And then there's prevention programs, where you're basically trying to prevent the problem in the first place. We would like it if all programs were prevention programs, if we got to that point, but we're not there. And so we've created problems because of our past practices, and so this is the range that we do need to operate as we move forward. Cleanup programs, 4 programs you'll see there. And again, you've probably heard of different ones. The Superfund program focuses on hazardous material sites. And basically, and we started off with about 255 sites. We've cleaned up and closed about 168 since 1980, and we have 87 remaining active sites. Again, we wish we would even be further along, but if you compare this state with other states, I think we're at about the top of the group of states as far as how we proceeded. And I think that's because we've had good support from the legislature, good on fund finance sites where the state pays for cleanup if we can't find responsible parties. And then I'll get into even the closed landfill program is a good example of where we kind of shifted to a different approach, and that saved us a lot of time and I think money in dealing with that. As far as petroleum remediation, that's dealing with the fact that we have a lot of storage tanks, gas stations, businesses, industry, and again, over time, those tanks have leaked. We have a very good petroleum remediation program in this state funded by the Petro Fund, where basically we pay 90% of the cost of cleaning up spills. And the idea was there is adding an extra penny or two on our gas prices, and as a result of that, we can generate $30, $40 million, which is used a year to help get the job done, rather than spending a lot of time in litigation and doing it. So the idea was it's associated with our travel, mobile sources, automobiles. Let's have everybody pay part of the price of making sure that we're dealing with the problems that are there. There have been 17,000 sites cleaned up in the last 20 years under this program. We have about 3,000 active sites in that program at any point in time. That program is right now scheduled to sunset in June of 2012. There will be a proposals coming forward to extend that for another 5 years. I myself do think that as we do that, we also have to have discussions about what the end game is. I don't think we can just continue funding all these programs without saying at some point in time, through our prevention program, and I'll get into that, where we have a tank program that's supposed to prevent leaks, where are we falling short and what needs to be done to make sure that at some point we can reach an end game on this and possibly look at privatized coverage, in other words, insurance or other things dealing with that, rather than government dealing with those type of programs. We also have then the closed landfill program, and this is again a very unique but good program in this state where it was finally decided rather than fighting over the landfills. If they were public landfills, the idea was for the state to take over that responsibility, to take the money that was generated through financial assurance for those sites, and then basically deal with the state running the program to clean those up. And what that has done is the litigation on those, when you're looking at hundreds of different responsible parties, would have been just ridiculous. And so what we've done by doing that is focused on the environment cleaning up, basically looking at having that covered through our remediation funds. And I think, again, that's been a great example. It's pulled them off from the Superfund program, and as a result, we've made tremendous progress. That program came into place in 1994, and again, in less than 20 years, we basically have gone and cleaned up over 100 of those closed landfills, and now they are cleaned up sites. We have 7 left at this point in time, and 3 are being worked on this year and should be closed up. And then finally, the last one, voluntary investigation and cleanup, that's a program where basically it's a pay for or fee for service. What we do is, again, what was creating a barrier for development in a lot of areas, we didn't have time through our Superfund program to deal with those minor sites. They had pollution problems. Think business, and a lot of you can talk a lot more about this than me, but business hates the uncertainty of coming in and thinking about coming onto a site, purchasing the site, and developing that site if they don't know what the long-term liability is. What this program was is we have a group of 12, 15 different staff where somebody comes in and they pay for our staff to go through and review the site and then basically provide a certification that what they are proposing to do will be adequate to clean up the site and also say that the development that they are proposing for the site will not make any of the environmental problems any worse. And so that has served to be a great tool for allowing brownfields to move ahead and be developed. And again, we deal with about 200 sites a year are still coming through there. Activity has slowed down a little because of the fact of the economic downturn. So there's been less development. So over the last year, we've actually seen a considerable decline in the amount of sites that are coming in under that program. This is just an example of the Bio Business Center in Rochester. And just to show again, this site in 2007 was still a parking lot in the middle of their business district. but as a result of coming in their program, they were able to clean up the residue that was there from a dry cleaning operation that existed from 1960 to 1983. And as a result of that, they have dealt with pollutants that included pH compounds, trichloroethylenes, and heavy metals. So it's just an example. And these things, again, allow that to go ahead. They're not being paid for by government. They're being paid for by the developer. It allows them, though, to get the certainty and the clean bill of health on that property so they can move ahead. The other management programs, there's two. One is dealing with solid waste, and on solid waste we deal with kind of two different types of programs. Two parties are primarily responsible for dealing with solid waste in the state as far as recycling, what happens with municipal solid waste, what happens in industrial. It's the state, PCA, and then it's the county. What we do through this program is we basically review solid waste plans that are submitted by the counties, where they have responsibilities to meet minimum goals relative to recycling. Right now, that's 35% recycling rate for outstate counties, and it's 50% recycling rate for in-state, for metro area counties. That does include a composting credit that they get for how they deal with yard waste. So there's an element in there that also allows them to move up a little higher. So in the metro area, as an example, the actual recycling rate right now is around 42% because of the 10% credit they get because of how they do deal with yard waste. That brings them up over that 50% rate. So the big thing there is, how do we deal with counties? Counties run their programs using SCORE funds. That's where there's money that is generated through a fee tax that exists on the disposal of waste, and that is put into a state fund. That fund is runs roughly around $65 million a year. Right now, the counties get about $14.5 million per year that is allocated out to them to help run those programs. We also have a regulated solid waste disposal and management program where we have permits for 260 different facilities. That ranges all the way from sanitary landfills down to demolition landfills to ash landfills. And so we have those permits going out. That's another program that, again, we feel that we've tried to use process improvement to do things in a very timely way on dealing with it. The one thing is, there's EAWs usually associated with doing a landfill because you have a lot of local interest and concern. And so some of those do take time as we're dealing with that. Right now, we do have a compliance rate of 98% on all across that range of 260 landfills as far as operating, and a lot of that includes also monitoring. So they're continually keeping track of whether or not they're having an impact on groundwater as they're dealing with that. Also, emergency response, and that's where, again, we respond to disaster and major spills. And again, this has to be a cooperative issue, because oftentimes when we have different emergencies, it involves a lot of different things, not just the environment. Often it first involves public health and safety. And so the picture there is actually from the 35W bridge collapse. And again, that was a great example of all different agencies and groups working together. Certainly there were issues there as far as the human tragedy, but at the same time, there were other environmental issues. And so we did have people on site working with an overall response team and dealing with that type of thing. We get roughly 3,000 calls a year, 3,000 different situations are reported to the agency that we follow up on. We deal with that through a screening approach where we determine immediately how big of a deal it is and whether we're going to work with local government to respond, or if it's a big enough situation for us to respond. And usually about 20% of the situations we get end up around 600, 700 a year we have to respond to or be involved directly. And dealing with that, we have people on call 24/7 in order to respond to those situations. Then finally, we have the prevention programs, and there's two prevention programs that we run. One is where we deal with tanks that are in the ground. Again, we have a program for cleaning up when tanks leak, but there also is a program, it's a federal program as well, where we have to basically ensure and have tanks registered. If somebody has a tank in the ground, they have to register with us if it's more than 500 gallons. And then at that point, we make sure that they have adequate safeguards, cathodic protection, or other things to make sure they're not leaking. And also, they either have to do inventory control or have some type of leak detection, electronic leak detection in the ground that allows them to know when there are leaks from there. So the idea is there is if there is going to be a problem, let's minimize the consequence of that problem as soon as we can as we're dealing with that. And then finally, on the hazardous waste side, again, we have about 12,000 businesses in the state that are licensed through the PCA. They have to be a licensed hazardous waste generator. We have three different sizes, large, medium, and small quantity generators. And then what we deal with them is we then determine how often we're going to inspect or how often we're going to review the manifests that they submit to us. Therefore, if hazardous waste is moving in the state, it has to be manifested. And those manifests have to be submitted to us. Now they're done electronically, so there doesn't have to be a movement of paper, so that we can see those manifests and understand and make sure that there's a cradle-to-grave approach, that not only where they're generated, but where they may be stored, and then finally where they're treated, managed, or disposed, that they're all fit within the hazardous waste regulations, both of the federal government and the state, as they're dealing with it. The major land challenges. One is, again, back to the solid waste. We've got to continue to increase our recycling and waste reduction in the state. We as a state, I think, if you look at other states, we're definitely in the upper group of states as far as our recycling rates and how we deal with waste. But we've kind of hit a plateau. We're at about the 40%. If you look at the overall rate for gift credits, we're at about 40%. There's definitely some states that have gotten in that 55 to 60, and certainly there's other countries. Smaller countries, European countries, that have even gone to the 55-60%. And I think what we need to do is figure out how we can keep moving forward than at higher level. And I think that may need to be how we look at the infrastructure we have to make sure that waste that we're generating, all of them are processed in the way so that we're taking out and doing resource recovery. Actually, in the metro area, there is a requirement that 100% of the waste generated in the metro area is processed. So even if it goes to the landfill, it's supposed to be processed. We're falling short of that. Right now, the agency is looking at starting to take that seriously and enforcing that with the metro counties. That is creating some tension between us and the counties, but I think we just have to show, since 60% of the waste in this state is generated in the metro area, I think we have a tremendous opportunity with the density of that waste, density of the population, to try to figure out how we can move to a different level. The other one is managing toxic and hazardous waste generated by households. We're now seeing that we're dealing well with the hazardous waste generated by business and industry. I think now we're seeing that just the waste that we're all producing in our household is something that we have to start looking at. We do have household hazardous waste programs in the state where there are opportunities for people to take their waste, put solvents, cleaners, anything, take it so it's disposed of properly. But the fact is we're only seeing about 10% of the households participating in those programs. So I think we need to figure out how we can move to a different level, keeping that waste out of the waste stream in the first place, because either it causes problems as you're dealing with trying to recover other good materials in your waste stream, or basically you're seeing problems in landfills, or as you're burning that waste, if you're burning it in an incinerator or waste energy facility. So we have to make sure that we're dealing with those properly. We have this find less toxic chemical option for use by businesses. And again, this is a tough issue because a lot of times maybe it's best handled at a federal level given the interstate commerce issues you have in any products. But there have been proposals in this state for product stewardship. So how we can start looking at different products and start spreading the responsibility for dealing with those. There have been in the past legislation proposals on paint product stewardship and other things, and I think it's always easier to deal with these type of issues up front versus waiting until they're in the waste stream mixed together with other things. It always is going to take much more effort, if not make it impossible, to actually then recover materials and deal with things in the most efficient manner possible. We're going to have to find incentives to reduce petroleum tank leaks, as I talked about that already. I think rather than just saying we're going to keep extending the date for that petroleum remediation program, we have to figure out, again, do we have some sense of an end game and some sense of how we're going to turn in that direction so we do have another approach rather than just government paying for it for the long term. And finally, we're going to have to complete construction of our closed landfills. Again, as I said, we've completed more than 100. We had 112 altogether. We've got 7 left. We're trying to figure out how we can use our remediation fund and will we have enough to deal with those, or will we also have to look at some bonding? Bonding could be used for those if they're public facilities, so there could be something we could deal with there. We try to look at both of those funds as ways to deal with those issues. Water programs, and I'm going to go through this very quickly because I think you've had some discussion here with regard to the Clean Water Legacy Fund and that, but I'll just say again, our water programs encompass about a third of all the staff at the agency. Not hard to understand. In this state, given all the water resources that we have, that makes sense. The vision, kind of simple, Minnesota has clean, sustainable surface and groundwater, and I think the important thing there, it's a water system, and we now understand, as we work with other agencies, it's not just the surface waters that we see. The groundwater are definitely part of the system that we have to pay attention to. Here are the different water programs that we run at the agency. There's 9 different programs, so there's a spread, and there's not a perfect division between all these, given that water is a system, it all kind of flows together, no pun intended. We focus on protection and restoration, regulatory and non-regulatory programs, and you'll see in here also those programs that come under the Clean Water Amendment and the constitutional funding that we now have on dealing with that. First of all, the important to talk about the Clean Water Fund. And the Clean Water Fund provides resources, again, for surface water ambient programs, provides for groundwater ambient programs, it provides for TMDLs and watershed protection, and finally it involves implementation of programs to deal with the problems that have raised or identified through TMDLs, total maximum daily loads. And again, it's just a way of talking about kind of a diet for a water body to ensure that it gets healthy on dealing with it. And a Clean Water Fund provides resources to do work and not funded at the present time through our federal partnership or through our environmental fund, which is primarily fees that we do charge for those that are in our different permit programs, and I'll get to that shortly. The work we do is supposed to augment, in other words, supplement our efforts in dealing with water quality that's covered in other funding, and it's not supposed to supplant. And that's an issue that, again, we've been dealing with the legislature and other agencies to make sure it's actually adding on to the protection, water protection efforts that we're implementing in the state. When we are dealing with water now across the state where you have so many lakes, so many streams, what we're now taking is a watershed approach. There are 20 or 81 watersheds in the state, and we finally decided the way to do that is break it down. So we're trying to get to 10% of the watersheds each year, therefore trying to complete 100% coverage over a 10-year period. And again, this watershed approach will allow more efficiency in how we deal with the Clean Water Legacy funding. The watershed approach will allow the agency to shorten the time it takes to complete TMDLs, because in a watershed, we can deal with multiple impairments and TMDLs at the same time. Because again, sometimes they overlap on issues, it allows us to deal with the efficiencies of dealing with those overlapping issues at the same time. And at the end of 10 years, the MPCA will have cycled through all the major watersheds and at least completing the TMDL and protection studies across the entire state. Again, in the TMDL program, there's 3 or 4 different levels. One is the monitoring. And again, I'll talk about that, the program to try to deal with the monitoring on a 10-year schedule. After monitoring, then you get into listing. If a body is impaired, and right now we're finding out at about 40% of the waters that we're assessing, we're finding to be impaired. In other words, they're not meeting some type of a water quality standard. Once they're listed, then the next issue is through this watershed approach, actually then doing a TMDL. That basically breaks it down and says both point sources, non-point sources, what needs to be done, what type of reductions have to occur so that finally we're meeting the water quality standards given the reduction in the effluents and the sources that are polluting a given water body. And then finally, there's an implementation plan, actually taking the effort both on the point source side and the non-point source side in order to get those programs completed and dealing with it. And what we're doing again is using this watershed approach. We're coordinating this with the other agencies, and I think it gives us, again, some type of a goal to reach. Here is the surface and groundwater monitoring ambient programs, and again, what you're going to see here, basically this just shows we're then trying to do the monitoring, both relative to surface water and groundwater, on that 10-year cycle. and that's what we're trying to do. The big thing here, though, is showing that now, I think, as a result of the support of the legislature, we're doing more in the area of groundwater. And the idea is that we're looking at, in any watershed, we're looking at 60 wells installed per year to complete the expanded groundwater network by 2014. We're going to look at sampling 20% of these sites for endocrine-disrupting compounds, and most of all, the idea would be to deal with those through regulatory programs and wellhead protection programs and other things, working with other agencies. There is actually, again, four different agencies that are involved in groundwater: PCA, DNR, Department of Health, and Department of Agriculture. I think we have good coordination and cooperation, but now the thing is to move ahead and make sure that we're advancing the ball as has been prescribed. Next is lake and stream transparency. This is another thing, and maybe you've heard about their citizen lake monitoring program, and this is just saying using citizens to also help. Through the watershed approach, we'll be doing much more intense monitoring of lakes and streams, where we're taking a lot of different parameters. But over the time we've used citizen program, we're just dealing with transparency, and the SECI disk is a way to understand. We have over 1,200 lakes that are involved in the citizen lake monitoring program at this time. It has given us a great tool in the past to understand at least what's the general health of lakes. And it's interesting, if you look back for lakes, since in 2009, the transparency data basically showed that 41% of the lakes in the program were showing improving trends, 17% were showing decline, and yet 42% showed no detectable trend. So again, we've seen that in some of these areas, it gives us some sense that actually, as a result of a lot of different programs, on-site treatment, other things, we're actually starting to reach a good trending point on a lot of the lakes across the state. With regard to the streams, what we were seeing in that same 2009 compilation were 34% of streams showing improving trends, 11% declining trends, and 55% showing no detectable trend. So at least we are staying stable at that point in time. Next one is just the TMDL and watershed protection, and I'll go to this quickly. I've kind of covered that, and the main thing is it's not just about restoration, it's also about protection. And again, what we try to do is it's our role to oversee the conducting or the development of TMDLs. The big thing here is to understand that we don't look at these being done just at the state level. The idea is using grant programs to let these being done at the local level. It's important that they're involved. It's their issues, it's their problems, and therefore you get the buy-in on them being involved in the solutions on dealing with it. Again, the key thing, I've mentioned it before on TNDLs, there's two tracks. You're identifying both the point sources that are contributing to the problem, but the non-point. And again, point sources, we have regulatory programs, non-point, we don't. So I'll get into that a little later. For non-point, we're basically looking at different incentive approaches or assistant approaches to make sure that we can have reasonable assurance that actually what should happen does happen as we move ahead.
Well, Commissioner, we're running out of time, and there's some members that have a few questions.
Okay.
And so if you could just have maybe some final comments, and thank you for moving along through your presentation rather quickly. Done a good job. So if you can wrap it up, and then we'll take a couple of questions.
I'll do it in about 3 minutes. You can see the rest of the...
I'll give you a minute.
Pardon?
1 minute.
1 minute. Good. Programs are there. Yeah, I think, again, because you probably had a presentation on Clean Water Legacy and what's happening, you've seen where we're going and the cooperation. Again, the challenges on the water side are how are we going to reduce non-point source impacts? And also, how are we going to complete our federal requirements on TMDLs? How are we going to prioritize the work, given the fact that we have additional dollars, but they're still limited dollars, and so we're going to have to make sure we're spending those wisely and how we can move ahead on a 25-year schedule. In the assistance programs, it's mainly saying that we have a lot of different assistance programs. We are a regulatory agency, but a lot of times assistance is a good way. You try to get people understand what do you expect them to do and then provide assistance on how to do it in the most efficient, effective way. And so we continue to deal with these programs in a lot of areas across, and we call those cross-medias because they don't just fit necessarily in one particular area. And at the end, I was just showing the challenges, and again, the big challenge there is how do we focus our assistance to provide us with the biggest results, and how do we engage the business community in dealing with that? Because it's got to be a partnership. We don't have the resources to do it all. We're finding tremendous cooperation in different sectors, where sectors, associations, those type of things step forward and actually help get the word out and provide tremendous amount of assistance to their members. And with that,
thank you, Commissioner.
Open for questions.
We have to take care of another a little bit of business here. First of all, Representative Hancock moves the minutes from the last meeting. Any questions, any comments on the minutes? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes are adopted. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Commissioner, there's a lot of interest in the biomass facilities, and we've got some that have come online. They have air permit processes that have gone through, and then as newer ones come online, they're utilizing new materials or different materials than the existing ones. Is there a good approach to, instead of starting from square one, that these existing facilities could bring in these new materials and not go through the entire permit process?
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, we are looking at that. In other words, that part of that whole idea of what type of a permit modification is needed as they're doing that. And I think, again, what the idea is how will it change the operating conditions of that facility? What type of equipment do they have? And I think what we're trying in all those areas, learning from lessons in the past and trying to see if there's ways we can streamlining those. But I think the biggest thing is we're trying to get good cooperation with the industry itself to step forward. In the past, we've seen some competition amongst in the industry, and I think what we're starting to see is a trend where they're actually willing to come in and look at it as an overall sector and help work with us to find some things that can work across the board to deal with the problems and yet deal with those in a timely way. So that's something we're looking at, Representative.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. A quick question on your air regulatory program. You mentioned 95% compliance, which is good, but for the other 5%, how do you set your fine structure, penalty structure, and where does that money actually go?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, Representative. What we do is we have a whole set of criteria and kind of a framework for how we set penalties, and we look at a couple different things. One is we look at economic benefit to start with, and again, Commissioner Austin talked about that. A huge part of enforcement is the equity issue. You have 95% doing it the right way, and it's taking time and effort to do it. And the idea of something's not, we first start at the fact of how much did they save by not doing the right thing. And that idea, at least part of the penalty should, or most of the penalty should recover basically on what they gain by not doing the right thing. Then in addition to that, we have penalty levels or levels that we look at for, again, the damage done to the environment. Some way of saying you've damaged the environment, there has to be some penalty to compensate the state for that. You're never going to compensate completely, but that's what we look at. To do it fairly, what we do is we have forums, enforcement forums. We have a group of leadership that gets together on penalties above a certain level to make sure that we understand how those penalties are being justified, how they are consistent with penalties we've gotten in the past in similar situations. So we try to take that very fairly. And finally, again, there's two things. If we're doing that penalty through an administrative penalty order, that can be appealed. We're getting actually very few appeals on those. Or if it's done through a stipulation because it's greater than $10,000, on those, if somebody wants, they can ask to come before our citizens board, and some have. So they can have a public forum if they think that that penalty level is unreasonable.
Representative Hancock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Schirkenbach. Very good report today. I just wanted to emphasize the last part of the report. You mentioned that the agency is basically a regulatory, but it's also an assistance agency. And if there's one comment that I hear in my constituency, it is basically that we have no trouble with the laws, but we have trouble with some of the rules and regulations, and I and the manner in which they're implemented. It goes back a little bit to the citizens board, and I see the citizens board. It says makes decisions on rules, environmental review, and controversial regulatory issues, and the commissioner is the chair. It looks to me like this is an attempt, at least, to to bring the public back in, at, not only in the active assistance area, but also in sort of a review area here. Have you found that the Citizens Board adequately protects, so to speak, the citizens in terms of... I've been on a lot of boards and seen a lot of boards where it's really a rubber stamp for the chair. And being that the commissioner is the chair here, does our MPCA Citizens Board really serve to, in my estimation, protect the citizen? Thank you.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative, you know, it's going to be my view after watching that board work again over 40 years. I've been running, I think we've had a total of about 50 different board members over those 40 years. I think they do a tremendous job. People getting on that board, they don't do it for the pay. And they do it because they have a commitment to the environment and interest in doing that. And so they're there. I think they basically, their real dilemma often is, we get a lot of citizens appear in front of them. That board spends a lot of time listening to them. A lot of times, the hard thing is, a lot of the issues that end up before the board end up involving areas that aren't under our purview or authority. And they're just citizens are concerned about something happening, and it may feel that it's not being addressed appropriately at the local level or something else. And a lot of times the toughest issue is for then the citizens to figure out there's a problem, they don't think they can fix it or at least respond appropriately, and that's where they get in tough situations. But I think they're human, and listening to the different issues that that come before them, I think they take them very seriously and definitely listen to citizens as they come forward and talk about issues from their perspective.
Thank you, Commissioner. We're at the end of our time. Thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Members, our next meeting tomorrow, we'll be listening to testimony on House File 72. We hope to wrap that bill up tomorrow. Please be on time. That's Representative Beard's bill on the coal moratorium. Meeting adjourned.